You ever feel like you're acting on autopilot or ever feel out of control? Yeah. What if you aren't responsible for actions, for your actions? What if your neurochemistry or your family history made you do it? My name is Jeff Holsklaw, and this is the Being With podcast. And we're talking about the intersection of neuroscience and faith. This is brought to you by Grassroots Christianity, which is growing faith for everyday people. Today, we have a special guest, Warren Brown, who's the professor of psychology and the director of the Lee Travis Research Institute at the Graduate School of Psychology, Fuller Seminary. He is a research neuropsychologist and neuroscientist, and he's written several books like Whatever Happened to the Soul, Did My Neurons Make Me Do It with Nancy Murphy, and recently he co-wrote Enhancing Christian Life, How Extended Cognition Augments Religious Community. He wrote that with Brad Strawn, who we just had on recently. But Dr. Brown, thank you for being on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to ask a couple more personal questions before getting into the, you know, your field. Yeah. How did you get interested or started on this field of psychology and neuroscience and neuropsychology?
Mostly in grad school. I mean, it was interesting to me as an undergrad, and then I applied both to a clinical psychology program and an experimental psychology program, and I got at USC, I got into the experimental psychology program, and then got working with a professor who was into brain function and how the brain operates for higher cognitive processing, and got interested in that, and went on to do a postdoc at UCLA Brain Research Institute, and then stayed at UCLA Brain Research Institute for 10 years.
So you just followed your interest and your curiosities.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I did something similar when I was studying philosophy. But when you study enough philosophy, and I think this is somewhat true maybe with neuroscience, you start feeling like, is this whole religion thing a crock, or how does this work? Have you had any kind of faith kind of struggles or just difficulties, you know, because when you're a doctor, a professor, researching how the mind works, has it been difficult for your faith?
Not exactly. I always felt that there was some way of reconciling this, but I didn't exactly know what it was. Mm-hmm. Not sure I totally know now. When I was in grad school, I actually studied with a guy who was a pretty serious Mormon, a guy named Gary Galbraith. And so one of the reasons we kind of connected with each other is we were both fairly serious about spiritual life and faith. But I must admit that most of my early career, I was guilty of what you might call conceptual apartheid.
Oh,
there's my science here, and there was my faith here, and I didn't try very hard to figure out and think deeply about, you know, what were the disconnects and what were the connects, and until I got working with Nancy Murphy in that book, Whatever Happened to the Soul, and so at that point, I took a dive into philosophy and theology and started thinking more seriously about how you reconcile a neuroscience view of persons with a spiritual and a cognitive and a psychological view of persons.
Yeah, so, well, good. We'll jump right into that in a second.
Okay.
What has been most helpful then? Like, what has like spurred on your faith as you studied on these things? Or what, it, just something about your mind or that your body or soul, you know?
The work that I started doing with Nancy and went into the couple books I did with Nancy Murphy and with Malcolm Jeeves and eventually with Brad Strawn moved me away from a sort of Cartesian mind-body dualism into understanding how one could have a fully funded Christian faith that nevertheless was embodied and took into account our bodily selves, including our nervous systems and brain. So, yeah.
So the more you learned, the more integrated you became.
Yeah. I mean, my science kind of went, you know, on, and there are occasionally things in the work I do in science that are interesting to me from the point of view of philosophy and theology. But what happened really is I got drawn into a lot of conversations involving the philosophy of mind and its relationship to Christian faith. That happens inevitably when you are a professor, even a neuroscience professor at a theological seminary, where you just get in these conversations, so you can't avoid them. So just being at Fuller was a lot of the impetus for me to flesh out a lot of things that I'd kind of set aside.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a lot of fun. I was like, I want
to
on all those conversations. So you did co-write a book with Nancy Murphy called "What Are Did My Neurons Make Me Do It?"
Yes.
What is all that about? Is the self really not a thing? Do I have no consciousness, no free will? Am I just a selfish gene, the way Daniel Dennett says? You know, I'm just genes trying to survive in the world, and my consciousness is just an elaborate lie so that I can get more calories and pass on my genetic code to another offspring.
That's obviously the statement of the problem, that if you believe in embodiment, that we are in fact bodily persons and not bodies with, you know, separate non-material minds or souls, then one has to contend with exactly the kinds of things that you just stated. So Nancy Murphy and I, who is a philosophy of mind professor at Fuller Seminary, and I wrote this book to try to defend a emergent and complex view of human beings that is embodied but doesn't allow for reductionism and therefore determinism. So reductionism is the idea that you could take my, let's say, my thoughts at the moment and reduce them down to nothing but certain neural connections and neural activity, that's all it is, that there it doesn't have causal power. It doesn't do things in its own right. My thoughts aren't effective as thoughts per se. And if you reduce that way, then it becomes determinist. And so did my neurons make me do it? Was answering the question, did my neurons make me do it or did I do it? And the answer is the latter. No, your neurons didn't make you do it. You did it. That there are emergent properties of us that gather all of these underlying bodily processes into a functioning whole that has properties that cannot be reduced. The body is necessary, obviously. If our brains get dysfunctional, things happen. But nevertheless, our thoughts, choices, feelings, experiences as whole persons are not reducible without loss to lower levels of functioning. Mm-hmm. So when I make a decision, it's a real me that makes the decision, even though I have to have lots of things going on neurally out of which that process emerges. Mm-hmm. That's kind of complex, but
yeah. No. So the me is built up of a nervous system, or you know, grouping of nervous systems. The me is, you know, part of neurotransmitters and you know, all the different ways that our synapses connect or fail to connect. And these, so those things are all part of me, but they don't. I can't be reduced to those things. That in some way, that there's an emergent or complex or something.
And for people of faith who have to deal with, for example, a older relative who gets Alzheimer's disease and seems to sort of lose their faith or get really bizarre in their behavior or do things they wouldn't otherwise do, you need some way to deal with that, to understand that and understand them as people and what's possible. There's less structure there out of which more sophisticated cognition can emerge. And so there's a real deficit there.
Yeah, for sure. So then how do we, what are good ways of integrating then those two things? Because I, you know, growing up in a more fundamentalist context, and now I'm in a more charismatic church, you know, if someone's struggling with depression, then, you know, they either are living in disobedience, would be like the more fundamentalist answer, and they need to confess their sin, or they're not spirit powered enough, you know, they need some deliverance from, you know, oppression. And I'm not against either of those options. Like, those are real options in some people's lives. But, you know, if we take embodiment seriously, there could be, you know, different bodily causes for depression, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, there are, for example, neurotransmitters that might be dysfunctional that need a anti-depression drug. Mm-hmm. So that you're not going to really get beyond your depression without some additional, or, you know, it may be both a antidepressant and time in prayer may both be necessary.
Sure. And maybe even some therapy and, you know.
Yeah. And there's some, yeah, exactly. So, but I think that's what I find helpful about the position I've taken is that you don't dichotomize the world. Mm-hmm. It's not like there's the spiritual world or there's the physical world, and these are not integrated in some important way. And then we face into things where they're clearly mixed up and integrated, and I can't figure out what's going on. Sure. And if we understand ourselves as more embodied persons, we are part of God's physical creation, but we are part of God's physical creation with a capacity, nevertheless, to understand and know Him and His presence in the world. That makes a whole lot of things clearer to me.
Mm. Yeah. And I've found that the more I learn, the less I have to feel like I need to know who's doing what and everything. Yeah. And I'm just open to multiple possibilities that there could be multiple causal explanations for different things that are going on. So, and integrate, just to summarize, at least kind of how I think about it, and you can say what you think, is that an integrated kind of Christian worldview, if you want to call it that, between, you know, whatever kind of however you think of the spiritual life and our embodied life. It's not like dualistic, so like Platonic or Cartesian, where the spirit is everything and the matter is kind of nothing. But it's also not reductionistic, where you know, the spirit and the mind, and those are all just kind of fantasies that we've created. And really, it's just the matter that matters. And a Christian worldview kind of says, well, both those things are kind of working together. And there really is an upward causality of energy in matter, you know, expressed through chemicals. Like, those things are emerging, you know, and then the impulses in my nervous system causing emotional reactions, which cause, right? So there is this upward movement. But what you're trying to say, I think, is that there's also some, I don't know if you use the word downward causality, but there's some sort of downward pressure that the thing we call mind is exercising.
Yeah. And that downward pressure we see very clearly when our mind brain is not working very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For whatever reason. And so the people with brain disorder are less capable of certain kinds of mental activity, and I think are less capable of participating fully in a Christian life, particularly as is embodied in the Christian group, the church, the ecclesia, the body. So that what we tried to say in extended cognition in the book Brad and I just did was that an important part of understanding what Christian life is about is to understand our connectedness and our nestedness within the body of Christ that we experience locally, that we plug into a larger body that enhances our Christian life in significant ways.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. You just wrote the book called Enhancing Christian Life, How Extended Cognition Augments Religious Community with Brad Strawn. And for you, how do you summarize this idea of extended cognition? We're not just brains and bodies, but there's a lot more going on there.
Yeah. So, a simple statement I think that Andy Clark makes is that we all think we're smarter than we think we are, particularly if you extract us from all of the intelligence-enhancing things that surround us in our environment. For example, my computer or my cell phone or whatever else. Brad may have talked about this, but for example, the example that philosophers use is an idea of a man named Otto, a fictitious man named Otto who has Alzheimer's disease and uses a pad of paper to write down things that he needs to remember. And then when he needs to remember something, he looks in his notebook. And the question is looking in your notebook really any different than consulting your hippocampus, which is the memory structures in your brain? And they argue, no, that this is in fact a network of cognition that involves the notebook as well as the brain and the body, and therefore cognition, in this case memory, is extended by using something outside of himself. And they argue that a lot of our cognitive life is not nearly as rich as if we were extracted and not able to continually interact with parts of our environment that actually nest into our environment a lot of our cognitive capacities. Mm-hmm. So Andy Clark says we make the world smart so that we can be dumb in peace. And I think that's kind of the way it is. We build a very useful, efficient environment for ourselves that makes us smarter. And by interacting with that, there's a whole lot of things we can do that we couldn't do entirely on our own. And it's by networking with these. So Brad and I decided we would take that seriously with respect to spirituality, that we're not nearly as spiritual or Christian if isolated on our own than we are when we are able to plug into and interact with a lot of things around us that enhance our spirituality, particularly the ecclesia, the church, other Christian persons, and then tools like Bible and Christian writings. And
Well, and the interesting thing later in the book that you guys mentioned was just how to think of rituals and even church tradition and hymn books and how these are kind of the relics of the past. It's not just tradition and traditionalism and things like this. It's really part of our collective cognition that we're carrying past into the future.
Yeah.
It really made me kind of think about those things differently. That was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Again, I think we give ourselves way too much credit as individuals. Mm-hmm. That, you know, could I really be a Christian if I had not been raised in a church or had not had Christian teaching or had not had Christian friends or had not been able to read the Bible? How Christian can one imagine one could be without this kind of extended life? Mm-hmm. And so Brad and I are both fairly focused on the importance of the church and the ecclesia and the enhancing of Christian life, that, you know, being sort of a solo Christian out there entirely on your own is probably possible, but not very robust.
Yes. Yes, so, absolutely. Well, that's what I really enjoyed about your book is that it doesn't just say, well, community is important for the Christian life. Yeah. It actually kind of fills out why and then how all those things are interacting kind of on a regular level, that not even my private spiritual life of Bible reading and prayer is really all that private because I have all these other selves and persons and conversations that are informing even that private time because I've been extended and received those things. And that's really helpful. Yeah. And it fills out more that we are social beings and it's what is primarily so different.
I know how to pray, and I know what to pray for, and I know the experience of prayer. So even when I'm praying on my own by myself, I am simulating and rehearsing and drawing on what I have received from the body of Christ.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, I know you're a researcher, and you deal with people who have like right brain kind of lateralization, kind of different things, but has there been anything that you're kind of working on or writing up that, you know, doesn't show up in any books that you're just really interested or passionate about that you'd want to just share a little sneak peek on your research life?
Yeah, I study a really interesting disorder. Let me back up philosophically and then tell you why I think this is interesting.
All right.
So one of the philosophical issues that Nancy Murphy and I dealt with, and Malcolm Jeeves and Brad and I all deal with the idea of emergence, which is this idea that a system, a complex system, as it works together, properties emerge in that system that you can't reduce to the elements in the system. So the philosophers use the idea of an ant colony. Ant colonies do things that you can't reduce to the capacities or activity of individual ants. What causes things to happen is what emerges from the interactivity of the whole colony. So I deal with people with agenesis of the corpus callosum, which is a disorder that people are born with, where the right and left cerebral hemispheres don't connect as richly. So there's 200 million connectors that go between the right side and the left side that are just not there at birth and never reappear. So you have this very disconnected right and left side of the brain. And I've been interested in for 25 years in studying what is the consequence of this to one's cognitive capacities and social capacities. And these people function, at least the ones we study, in the normal range. And you know, often you can be in a conversation with them and not quite realize. And then after a while, maybe they come out as just a little bit odd or different than, and you're not sure why and whatever. So the idea of emergence is it's based on interactivity and interconnectivity. And I'm dealing with a group of patients for whom there is less neural interactivity by 200 million neurons between two big cognitive structures, the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. And what we find is that the, first of all, they're persons in absolutely every way. They have less robust, but nevertheless clearly existent higher cognitive processing and higher social interactive understanding. So, for example, we found that they don't understand second order meaning in language. That is, jokes usually have kind of one meaning, and what's really funny is the alternative meaning. Or metaphors have one sort of concrete meaning, but what's really interesting about the metaphor is its alternative meaning. And they have a very difficult time structuring that. So, and that kind of things comes up in a number of different areas. Their creativity is not, you know, great. They're creative in some ways, but don't really create and structure in their mind what's beyond what you just told them.
So
this relates to emergence. This is an example of what we are trying to talk about, that the what emerges is has to do with interactivity and connectivity. And so you've got two normal structures here. They just not as much emerges because they don't interact as richly and robustly. So
we really need to be whole-brained people. We actually, just a couple episodes ago, I interviewed someone called Michael Hendricks, who wrote a book called The Other Half of the Church. And he argues that our church life in the West is too left-brained. And so we are missing kind of the creative. Yeah, I know. It all depends on what you mean by left brain.
But, yeah, exactly.
But which is, I want to do some, maybe I should have you on. We could talk all about right and left brain research, because there is something to it. But I think the popularized views of these things is not quite right.
Yeah.
And so maybe we should talk about right and left lateralization at some point. But he was arguing that kind of our character runs, you know, at a fast speed where we're interacting with the world. And, you know, our left brain primarily, you know, the logical, linguistic, however you want to talk about it, it kind of runs a little slower and it doesn't get the nuances of meaning. It doesn't, it doesn't kind of live in the mystery as often and things like that. So I think there's something to that. But maybe
I'm not sure you need I'm not sure you need the terms left brain and right brain.
Oh, okay. Well, what would be a better term?
Well, you have one processing mode that's verbal and linear, and you have other processing modes that are more spatial, immediate, and more connected with certain experiences of the body that we call emotions. Mm-hmm. And And then you have the whole idea of habit. And I think we need to pay more attention on our Christian life to the idea of habits, which is the idea that life runs off at way too fast a speed to do anything but react in a somewhat habitual way, or the way we usually react. And it's very difficult. Well, we don't usually don't have time, but even if we did, it's difficult to get ourselves to step back and think about our activity. So you don't get to stop the merry-go-round. It just keeps spinning. You can't stop it and say verbally and linearly. And
it's all connected. So do you, I know some people talk about fast and slow. Do you think that's a better way to talk about the brain processing then?
It's another better way.
It's slightly better.
Well, no, it's, I think we need all of these ways of thinking about left brain, right brain is really used as a metaphor. Mm-hmm. And so it's probably a metaphor as long as you don't take its neural embodiment too seriously. It is a good metaphor for two kind of ways of dealing with the world.
Right. And they're always in conversation. Well, except for the patients you deal with, they're both in conversation with each other anyway, so you can't separate it too much. Well, good. Well, my last question, I mean, if you don't want to ask this, answer this, that's fine. But at the end of the book, the most recent one, Enhancing Christian Life, you kind of just talk about, well, there's things that need to be kind of still left unsaid, that neuroscience can't really get at the questions of, you know, God and does God exist and religion, because those could be reductive kind of questions. I know there's lots of neuroscientists and cultural anthropologists that do reduce all God talk to just, you know, are struggling to find meaning in a meaningless world, things like that. So how does that kind of, you know, interacting with God, or how do we speak about God? What are good and bad ways to use neuroscience to talk about God?
Bad ways are the ways, a guy named Ramachandran at one time, about 10 or 15 years ago, talked about the God spot. And this was a reductionist view that, you know, what religion is activity in some areas of the amygdala and each part of our temporal lobes. And that was the God spot.
Feelings of transcendence and disconnection from the world. And we can reduce mystical experiences by this brain region.
Well, but it's not that our whole selves, including our amygdala and our emotional systems and our significant system, aren't heavily involved in these things. So anything that is significant in the world will activate certain brain systems, including the amygdala. And so, of course, it would be involved in spiritual life and experiences. And so I think things are experienced bodily. So any religious experience, you can track a lot of things in the body. And there may be some of them that tend to be more involved when the experience has the label or idea of religious, because that's particularly important. And those areas are not quite as involved when the experience is not religious. But that, those are descriptions of us as bodies and how we interact with the world. And I don't think there's any religiously unique way that my body interacts with the world. But the issue with theology and Christian faith is, does something exist outside of my body? Mm-hmm. Is God present in the world? Is God's spirit present in the world? And that you just, there's no way to know that from what the body does. Mm-hmm. If God is present in the world, that's going to be very significant to me. It's going to have a lot of bodily implications for me at the moment. And, but it's not reducible to that. I mean, that could happen at a baseball game. I mean, so.
Especially when the Cubs are winning for me.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe the Dodgers for you, but you're like the arch-enemy.
I'm a Dodger.
Yeah. Well, I'm
yeah.
sure you
guys. So, one of the problems with some of that research is incomplete set of background comparisons. So you do a person in a religious state of some kind that they define, and then you do somebody in some other state that's not, and you just say, oh, well, because the brain acted a little differently in the state that the person called religious, then the religiousness is reducible to this. Well, how many other conditions are there in the world that would have given you the same mm-hmm. neural activity because of the depth of significance of that experience to the person experiencing it? So it's not a God spot. It is just a domains of the brain that process things that are really significant to me. And that has nothing to say either way about whether God exists in the world or not. Mm-hmm. So neuroscience cannot deconstruct theology, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And I think, again, and we've been talking about this, is that, you know, we need complex answers for complex systems in the human brain. Yeah. And human relationships and civilization is probably the most complex thing that we know and have encountered. And too often we have simplistic, reductionistic explanations for these things, like, oh, we did a couple MRIs or different kind of brain scans, and we see that blood flow to this area, and so therefore this means, but blood, you know, you weren't looking, but you know, when I was thinking about my mom and how she might pass away soon, maybe the same thing was happening, or maybe I was thinking about the birth of my son, and maybe the same thing, but you weren't asking that question, right? And so I think sometimes we can be reductionistic, and a book comes out, an article, and then a newspaper article that says X, Y, and Z, and religion is just neuroscience. It's like, no, it's not that simple.
One of our traps is to suppose always one cause. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When in fact, everything that happens to me and my life and my body is multiply caused. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff going on. Old habits of this and that, and thoughts about this and whatever context I'm in. And so there's multiple causations, and those merge together into something that I identify as me as an agent. And, but that agency can't be reduced to one cause.
Well, as a theologian, you know, who studies theology, I always go back to the two natures of Christ, that we have these, you know, Jesus was fully human, fully divine, and this are two kind of causal stories that we have to take seriously. But we don't just have to go to theology for that. I think, you know, like light is both a wave and a particle, and it has these two different kind of natures. And scientists still haven't unified general relativity, which, you know, tracks the movement of gravity and stars, with quantum mechanics and how electrons and how all these things fit together. Yeah. There's like two different views of the world that we don't know how they fit together, but they are incredibly accurate. And I think we in faith, we can look at, those questions of doctrine and, as a reason for holding two causal kind of modalities, but there's also lots of physical sciences that do the same thing. And so we're not out to lunch for doing this. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been super fun for me. And we've gotten a couple thumbs up online on Facebook and YouTube as we've been talking. We've been sitting with Dr. Warren Brown of Fuller Seminary, who just wrote Enhancing Christian Life. You should check it out. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.